This is Autoline After Hours with Gary Vasilash, episode 394 for October 6, 2017. Mazda's Xtreme Engine. Watch Autoline After Hours live at Autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific Time. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or on YouTube.
Autoline After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems. And by Hyundai, better drives us.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for joining us. As you can see, John is not here again, but Dr. Data will be back this week. He wasn't here last week, so he'll be joining us. We've got a great show. Robert Davis from Mazda. We'll speak to him in a moment. But first, Todd Laza, Automobile Magazine. Now, Todd, the last time I saw you, you were leaving Hall 9 in Frankfurt, and you're on your way to Hall 11 to go see what the BMWs are doing. And,
yes.
Maybe we'll get to a little Frankfurt. Don't know, but it was a rather fascinating conversation. So
yeah.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Gary.
And we've got Mike Austin back. Mike Austin, who is the digital content editor over at Hagerty, and he's got his very nice Hagerty shirt that has a little logo, which is a 4-speed manual transmission. So you guys are all about saving old cars.
Loving driving. There's new cars. We do new car things, too.
Loving driving. Yeah. And that's a perfect segue for Robert Davis.
Yes, thank you.
And who's Senior Vice President, Mazda North America. Now, Robert, you're becoming, like, the most popular guy on this show. I mean, we just had you on a few weeks ago up in Traverse City. And,
yeah.
And you were getting yourself into some trouble up there talking about the wonders of internal combustion engines. But before we get to that,
okay,
you guys have been a rather busy company because, I mean, in the short period of time since we last talked to you up there, you guys announced that you're getting together with Denso and Toyota on a common architecture program to make electric vehicles. Is that the case?
Yeah, Gary, what we did is we announced a joint venture together to develop a common architecture for EVs. We all know and we've all been talking about EVs and where they're at in the future and understanding and building, taking the best from all the three partners and applying them centrally to get economies of scale and best practices from what the three companies do best. We thought it was a great idea, and that got announced just a few days ago. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, one of many announcements since Traverse City.
Yeah, and then before that, it was an announcement that you and Toyota are going to begin manufacturing together in the United States.
Yeah, we announced a new manufacturing facility here in the U.S., which is a 50-50 joint venture, around 4,000 jobs. The location's still to be determined, but we're just excited about showing our commitment to the U.S. market from Mazda and then showing and seeing Toyota's confidence in Mazda as a manufacturing partner. As you know, in Salamanca, Mexico, we already do joint production with Toyota down there. So, again, taking the best of both companies and learning from each other.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was interesting in the EV Common Architecture Spirit Company Limited that you guys were picked because of your product development skills. I thought that was fascinating, that's what you guys are known for being able to cleverly come up with things, and I think that you two would certainly agree with that.
Yes, and I would, too, there's something really interesting with Toyota combining with you guys in that, of course, they've done other joint ventures with Subaru BRZ, for example. But we all know about Mr. Toyota's interest in bringing more passion to his cars, and Toyota's, no question, have great reputation for quality and reliability, but they don't have the sort of they don't appeal to enthusiasts the way Mazda does. So, can you talk about that at all? Is there any?
Well, I think Mr. Toyota saw that what Mazda was and the cars that we built were the cars that he liked. He's an enthusiast.
Yeah.
So it's real easy to make that association. I think as they dug deeper, they saw the manufacturing and product development capabilities of Mazda, which was Gary's point, and realized how a small company has some advantages, has some disadvantages, where we recognize that, but a small company has some advantages in how quick and how fast decision-making can be made, mm-hmm. and how purity of purpose is important in a lot of decisions that you make. I mean, it's just like vintage cars. A lot of those cars were built with a very pure purpose. And so understanding that and bringing that to a table and bringing it to a company like Toyota, we see it as a big honor because they're recognizing, not only does the market recognize it, but when a competitor recognizes it, it gives you great pride. It is also recognized as our manufacturing capability and our production capability are very closely aligned. Monosukuri at Mazda was about concurrently developing the car and the production process at the same time, not the traditional way where you develop the vehicle and then you hand it off to the production guys and go, okay, we're done, it's your job now. That was done very much at the same time.
And of course, Hiroshima, the Mazda factory there is very famous for being able to produce all sorts of models out of the same manufacturing plant, very unusual, maybe unique in the industry. You mentioned the Mexican plant where you build a small Toyota sedan for, I want to keep calling it the Scion IA, but the name has changed now, of course.
It's the Corolla IA.
The Corolla IA, yes, based off the Mazda 2. Can you talk at all about what you're planning to do in the U.S. in terms of what kind of products?
We've only talked about the U.S. plan as building a crossover for Mazda. It's not been determined which one. Let me refine that. It's not been made public which one it's going to be. We know
that.
Tell
us now. Break it here.
The last thing I do.
Just between us.
Yeah.
We know that what's going on in the marketplace with crossover, so that's obviously the right thing to do. And it's also the timing of that plant is really important and really impressive. I mean, when I heard the original announcement of 2021, I mean, that's in production facilities,
right.
That's tomorrow.
So,
to have not already announced the mm-hmm. site, it's going to be a quick one. So mm-hmm. it's pretty impressive that the two companies think that they can do that and do it together. Obviously, Toyota has a lot of expertise in plant selection and building. We've just built one in Mexico, so it should be a fun project.
And I would be remiss if I didn't mention that you're mentioning the driving spirit of Mazda, that Robert brought a MX-5,
Absolutely.
AKA Miata, to the studio today, which is just sitting there. It just looks like it wants to be driven.
Mm-hmm. So one thing about Mazda, you talk about being a small company and the flexibility and innovation that you have. And the thing I thought of was the latest round of SkyActiv engines where they're built using a lot of CNC manufacturing. And even from a design size, they've sized the smaller and the larger engine are basically scale models of each other,
right.
Instead of being D-stroke or D-board versions of the same engine.
Right.
And which creates advantages, but also needed these kind of innovative solutions to make it production feasible. You look at Toyota, they certainly are experts at manufacturing too, but they're a much larger company. They usually deal with higher volume and higher scale. When you guys approach this kind of a partnership, how do you make sure that you keep the good parts and it doesn't get tangled up in a morass?
Well, I think, Mike, the situation is that both companies have respect for each other. And it's not a takeover kind of situation. So they're working in cooperation. And I think because both companies are Japanese, that level of cooperation and that level of respect is probably even more emphasized. So I think what we've seen so far, just through our early days in this, is the two companies do have a lot of respect for each other, and they recognize the strengths of each. So your CNC example is a good example on engine blocks and cylinder heads. I don't know that that solution would work in that environment where it's making 1.2 million units for us today and it would need to make 4 million units for Toyota tomorrow.
Right.
So I think the solution, it's a solution-based approach. We try to approach everything on trying to take away the things that are intuitively opposites, more power, better fuel economy. So intuitively, you would think more power, less fuel economy. but we try to take those things and move them on the same axis where you, and that's our decision-making, our problem-solving kind of ability is to take things that intrinsically you think are counterproductive to each other and make them both benefit by a new design.
So the big announcement that you guys made, well, I guess the Toyota announcements are pretty big. But arguably, with SkyActiv X engine technology, which is spark-controlled compression ignition. Did I get that right?
I'm glad you did.
Okay. I watched the video this morning. So basically, you guys, explain how this engine works. And let me tell you, we've got more questions for you. One guy sent in 21 questions. Greg Dunn,
wow.
God bless you, 21 questions that you sent in about this, and we got a whole bunch more. So briefly, give us an overview of what this is. Then we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to do the whole big deep dive into this.
Okay. Well, first of all, go to Inside Mazda on Mazda USA. There's a great four-minute video there that talks about the SkyActiv X. But basically, the engineers have been able to take what we view as the best technology in gasoline engines and the best technology in diesel engines and combine them. So X means a crossover between a gasoline and a diesel engine. And functionally, normal gasoline engine runs at about 14 to 1 fuel-air ratio. So there's 14 parts fuel to 1 part, or 14 parts air to 1 part fuel. If you got a rotary engine, it's about 12 to 1. But the SkyActiv X is about 30 to 1. So basically, it's been able to take technology primarily through spark control, injector control, and valve control to effectively raise the compression ratio and raise the fuel-air mixture to have an ultra-lean compression or ultra-lean combustion moment. And the difference between it and HCCI is it uses a spark to control that moment because the external factors of HCCI move too slowly. To be able to have a spark control the explosion in the chamber, whether it's charged heavily or charged lightly, is the key and the differentiator between Mazda with SkyActiv X. So we see it as having around 20 to 30% more fuel economy, to delivering all the good things that you recognize in diesel engines, great mid-range torque, all the good things that you see in gasoline engines, great responsiveness, quiet, those kind of things. And we think it's the next step in internal combustion engines. As we talked about the last time we were together at the Traverse City, we don't believe the internal combustion engine is dead. We still think it has more life and that we want to improve that as we go forward with our technology.
Okay, so I'm going to slide in a quick question here from Mike from San Francisco. Says SkyActiv is impressive technology, but will it have a future in the world of EVs in 4 to 5 years?
I believe it will, because I think if you look at all the infrastructure plans and all the discussion about EVs, EVs are part of the solution. EVs aren't the silver bullet. This solution is a bunch of different things. So I think SkyActiv X, along with layered, what we call a building block strategy of having great, efficient internal combustion engines, having other hybrid activity, having electric motors to assist them, is the building block strategy. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is we feel strongly that technology should be available on all models, not just on one model. So this is something that we can put in every Mazda model, mm-hmm. not just having an EV in a particular vehicle like a Mazda 3.
Right. Okay, we're going to take a quick break, hear from our friends at Hyundai, and then we're going to be back, and we got a whole bunch we got to get to on the SkyActiv X. So take it away. Okay, and we're back with Robert Davis from Mazda, who is explaining the SkyActiv X technology, new engine technology that, I think it could be described as being revolutionary, but maybe that's just me. Mike.
So I was, when you said there's a huge difference between HCCI, which is homogeneous charge compression ignition, which is switching between spark and compression ignition. I just assumed, I even read a bunch about SkyActiv-X. I didn't realize, is it sparking the whole time?
Yeah, Mike, it sparks okay. every time, and it basically sparks to make sure that it's got the exact environment that the car needs to be efficient. HCCI normally, without a spark, has a very narrow kind of usefulness window in real-world driving dynamics. So it does, it sparks. The other interesting thing about it is the spark profile and the injection profile literally can change between every cylinder. So figuratively, based on the driving environment, the spark profile, the injection profile, and the relevant or compression ratio can be different in number one as it is in number four as the conditions change. That's how fast the mm-hmm. computer can keep up.
So does that mean that you might not run on all cylinders at certain points?
No, Todd. Okay. As it changes, it would change the profile as it would need to change.
Okay.
The compression event. The
I was thinking
event.
Of Delphi's technology, though, mm-hmm. you know, right. where they changed the... Anyway, I'm getting over my okay. head engineering-wise. But the SkyActiv-X also calls for, or Mazda said that you'd like to see a higher octane gasoline, if I have that correct. Isn't that part of the...
No, Todd. I think it was just the testing that we've done has been in Japan, which generally has a better quality of gas.
Okay.
I don't think we've called for it.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll make those adjustments as we do the market ready. You know, the existing SkyActiv technology gasoline engine has a 13-to-1 compression ratio mm-hmm. in Japan, and it has a 12-to-1 here based purely on fuel quality. So I don't think we've decided that yet.
Okay, we have a phone call from Kevin. Could we bring the phone call in, please?
Hi there. This is Kevin from Nashville, Tennessee. I have a question for Robert. This new technology, spark compression ignition, it's quite revolutionary. What enabled Mazda to take a project so big with a lot of investment and a lot of faith and bring it all the way to conclusion? Love the show. Love the insight. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Kevin. I think what we did is when we first embarked on SkyActiv technology in 2007, we looked at the eight major elements of both gasoline and diesel engines, and we evaluated where the industry's technology was on those eight elements. And then we said, okay, what are the easy things to fix or the easy things to change, and tried to decide and think differently to fix those eight elements. And that's where SkyActiv G and SkyActiv D came in, on board in 2010.
D being your diesel version,
being
the gasoline
yes.
version.
Then we always knew that we were ready. We knew we improved things, but we also knew that there was another level of improvement that was possible. So since that time, the engineering group at Mazda, the powertrain group at Mazda, Hitomi-san primarily, has been really looking through and trying to find solutions to those activities. So knowing that HCCI, what we talked about earlier, was kind of the holy grail in the middle of this diesel-gasoline kind of battle, that's where he started trying to come up with solutions. So it's not one thing. It's a multiple of things that get you there, and trying to correct all eight of the activities and make them as efficient as possible is what got to SkyActiv-X.
See, what I find interesting is you know, we've had folks on the show talking about HCCI, and you know, I remember General Motors had a big program on that, and but what led you guys to realize that you needed the spark in addition to the compression?
I think the ability of managing the compression or the combustion event. Without the spark, you're basically forced to only... You don't know when you're going to have the explosion in each cylinder. By having the spark and by having very precise control of that spark, you now manage the event versus the air fuel ratio and the movement of the piston to create the event for you.
Is, Is this basically the end of diesel development at Mazda? I mean, do you have any reason to continue working on diesel if you have this revolutionary alternative, basically?
I think there is still room to develop diesel. A lot of markets around the world rely heavily on diesel and have not made the switch. So, I think we can always make improvements. I get cautious about making, you know, definitive statements, because I think if we're all truly concerned about the environment, we need to continue to improve all of our technologies and all the technologies in both gasoline and diesel engines as we move forward.
One of the 21 questions from Greg Dunn, is it scalable to all cylinder sizes, and what types and sizes of engines can we expect from SkyActiv-X?
So it is scalable. We've not yet talked about the different variations, but I think if you go look at the Mazda lineup, you can probably come with a pretty obvious answer. I'm not going to say that answer on TV, but Mike said it earlier, talked about the first generation of SkyActiv was a scalable program. And really our focus is not, again, on the tooling or the machines to make the engine, but it's about creating the best combustion event in each cylinder, no matter how many cylinders there are or what size they are. And that change in manufacturing process allows us to do that.
This is an interesting question from Barry Thiessen. How did you keep this development off the radar for so long? Seems like it overachieves in every area the rotary didn't. High efficiency, high torque. But it is interesting that, you guys cover the industry very thoroughly. And, did you have any idea that these guys were working on something like this?
Go ahead. I was going to say, it's rare. Other companies that have worked on similar advanced technologies, they announce, they're talking about it, they put out papers. It's rare where someone goes, yeah, here it's running. We're going to have it in a year. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, very, very much the same thing. Yeah, not on our radar.
Yeah, it's just, so how'd you do it?
Well, I think one of the advantages of being a Hiroshima, Japan-based company, you guys don't visit the home office very much. I think it's just the fact that we work very closely with suppliers. We distracted you a couple of times with some rotary engine stuff that got you off going into the wrong place. I remind everybody of the RF. They hear the MX-5 RF was a great surprise in New York a couple of years ago. So we're able to keep our mouth shut.
Okay. Let's here's some Mazda more general questions, non-specific to the engine. Danny Youngblood wants to know Swiss Army knife concept.
Yeah, I saw that question before we went on the air. He's speaking to a design exercise we did, and I don't even know, Danny, how long ago that was, but I remember it. It was just trying to build a vehicle that had a very flexible feature set, pickup truck, four-wheel or four-seater, two-seater, roadster. It was a fun little project. Thanks for sending the pictures, because I had forgotten all about it. But fun project that we did. Nothing going on that I know about on the Swiss Army.
Was
project.
It sort of like the Nissan NX Pulsar?
I was going to mention that car that had a flexible tops thing. You could make a hatchback out of it or a sporty coupe. Mm-hmm. And just keep the other piece in your garage, I guess. Probably didn't work because most people who bought those cars were probably living in apartment buildings instead.
Speaking of buying cars, Ron Paris from Santa Rosa, California says, next year I'll be in the market for a five-door hatch to replace my 2013 CX-5. I'd love to stay in the Mazda family and purchase a Mazda 3, but find it hard to get past the choppy ride and poor interior space utilization of the current model. Does Mazda plan to address these issues, and when can we expect to see a new model that retains the virtues of the current car while correcting these well-known deficiencies?
Wow. So,
harsh, but yeah.
Or we won't talk about specific product planning or timing, but I think your timing is about right.
Okay. Tony, when will the CX-5 diesel debut in the U.S.?
Wow, that's a great question, Tony. Tony, I don't answer that question because I've gotten it wrong 3 times. Mm-hmm. And I just know that if I open my mouth, and I do know the current production period and the production date, but if I open my mouth, I'm for sure it'll be delayed. So you're just going to have to watch out. But it's good. We drove it 2 weeks ago. Been working very effectively with the EPA and the ARB on the calibration, and I think you're going to be pleased.
So for those of you who don't know, the ARB is the California Air Resources Board, which probably isn't all that friendly to diesels, and if you guys are doing all right with them, I'm sure you're doing great. Scott Lathrop, will the Mazda Speed 3 return?
Scott, probably not as you know it. I think there's an opportunity to build a better, higher horsepower, more higher refinement vehicle. But the use of Mazda Speed probably will no longer be used. I think there's a good example of that with the Signature CX-9 and what we've got going on with there. So that's really the drive toward the next generation, what we call SV or special versions.
So the hint there seems to be that Signature might be your new Speed, that will fit other models.
I would say, Todd, Signature is a not a replacement, but it's a directional. You see what we're doing with Signature, you understand what we'll do with special versions.
Okay.
All right, so we're going to go back to the Skyactiv-X for a moment here. Doug, and I'm going to mispronounce his last name, but Vasilash isn't easy to say either. So Doug Danazin, I think. Sorry, Doug. How quickly will GM, Toyota, Volkswagen Group adopt the spark-mediated engine technology, do you think?
I don't know, Doug. I mean, in recent weeks even, people have been talking about stopping development of powertrains, of internal combustion powertrains. You know, I honestly think that's a big mistake. Again, as if you look at the adoption of electric and the use of internal combustion, it's got quite a long life left in it. So making those engines as efficient as you can. I'm not totally clear with what level of technology is, you know, patented, what can be licensed, all that stuff. It's still a little bit unclear for me. But I'm hoping that they all do and create a better internal combustion engine moving forward for all of us.
So I'm a little unclear on, so with partnership with Toyota, can you say whether the new Skyactiv-X technology will be in Toyota's using Mazda-built engines, or will they adapt the technology to their own engine lineups?
So, Todd, I think it's too early to know that yet. Certainly the activity that we've been working on with Toyota on powertrains so far has been taking their hybrid and their electric technology to our vehicles. Mm-hmm. So I think it's just too early to tell which way that'll go.
Okay.
Michael Gelvin wants to know, will there be a higher powered Miata MX-5 anytime soon?
Sorry, I can't talk about
that's
that.
A 30, that's a, what is that now, a 37-year-old question, I think, or 27-year-old question, sorry.
Dana Point John asks, Robert, are you still racing and what are you driving?
Well, thanks, John. I'm driving an RX-8. I plan to drive an RX-8 in the NASA 25-hour coming up here in December. I just restored an RX-3, the Bex Beer IMSA RS car. And don't tell my wife, but I'm 8 months pregnant with an IMSA GTU RX-7.
All right. So one of the things before the show that we were talking about, and an issue that is important to Mazda and is important to people, is important to the industry, and this is the Takata airbag situation where the airbags are not necessarily doing what they're supposed to be doing and that they need to be replaced. So tell us about that situation.
Well, everybody knows that there's 42 million cars out there with Takata airbags in them that need to be replaced. And I'm just trying to figure out new ways to get it done because as OEs, most of these bags are pretty old. For example, for me, my oldest bag is 2001, and I don't really have a relationship with a customer that's three or four, you know, sales into a 2001 MPV or a 2003 Mazda 6. So we're just looking for ways to try to innovate that ideas, working with DMVs, working with insurance companies, working with independent repair facilities to get these airbags replaced. So I ask the audience that if you know of anybody that might have one of these cars, get it fixed. It's not a joke. Takata's got a great app on your iPhone. You can scan your license plate, and it'll tell you if it's got an active Takata airbag recall on it.
Your license plate or your VIN?
License plate, because it then looks up the VIN on the DMV websites.
Wow.
So,
pretty good for a company that's now bankrupt, right?
for everybody in the industry, dealer-wise or OEM-wise, you know, let's just make sure that we're making it a priority. I don't know if anybody has seen some of the pictures of overinflations from Takata airbags. They're pretty scary. And I think as an industry, we owe it to get those cars fixed.
And to clarify, your oldest cars with Takata airbags, the affected Takata airbags are 2001. They go up to about what model year?
We've got some that aren't currently active recall go up to 2016.
Okay.
But remember, Takata is affected by time and heat.
Yeah.
So if you've got a car that's older, that's been in a hot climate, maybe it's not in a hot climate, high humidity, it's time to check it and see.
The older, the more urgent.
Right. Okay.
So with these replacements, the Takata ones, you mentioned that they're using different formulations, different propellants, but how do we know in another 10 years or another 20 years we're still going to have airbags? What's the design life for an airbag anyway?
You know, Mike, I don't know. I think actively 15 years should be fine. I think all I know is most other airbag propellants are much more stable than the ammonium nitrate that were used in the Takata airbags. So I would be very comfortable, particularly in classic cars like my 1990 Miata. I'm pretty comfortable that airbag is going to go off.
Okay, we've got more questions from the audience. I promise we'll cut you loose, but... AG wants to know, will the CX-3 be the only subcompact Mazda in the U.S. and notes its base price is significantly higher than that of a subcompact car?
I guess I don't understand the question.
I think he's asking about Mazda 2 coming to the U.S.
Oh, okay. No plans for the Mazda 2 to come to the U.S. I think, you know, I got a lot of criticism. Certainly it wasn't my own choice to make, but the Mazda 2... if we look at the segment that a Mazda 2 competes in, it's pretty tough.
Yeah.
It makes Mazda 3 and Mazda 6 segment look like a cakewalk. Mm-hmm. So, no, I just don't have enough volume there.
Next generation, this is from Isaac, next generation SkyActiv platform. Will there be new transmissions and other technology in the SkyActiv family to come in 2019?
Yeah, Isaac, if you look at the material that we did with the technical review a couple of weeks ago when we announced SkyActiv X, we talked about the platforms. We didn't really spend much time on transmissions, but yeah, the whole suite of SkyActiv technologies is evolving and is getting updated. Again, it's about moving safety to a new level, moving systems on driver comfort, seating to new levels. It's about fuel economy. You know, fuel economy is all based on weight, aerodynamics, along with the powertrain. So you're going to see improvements in all those areas. I think I said enough to answer his question, but not enough to get in trouble.
Okay, and back to Doug Danizen again, apologize for the name. Is the enabler for the SkyActiv X technology faster computational power?
That's a big benefit. I mean, it's a big benefit in control systems on valve timing, control systems on injectors, and control systems on spark. So on a big, broad term, yes. Mm-hmm. On a very narrow term, those areas are certainly. Okay. And then design of key components like piston design, cylinder head design are also key in that.
Okay, and the last one from Scott Lathrop. My brother raced an RX-4 and co-drives an RX-4 in vintage racing. Can you help them with sponsorship?
No, sorry. I wish I could help myself with sponsorship. That's why I'm going to work until I'm 90 years old.
And we'll be happy that you work until you're 90 years old, and we'll have you back times between now and then.
Thank you.
So, Robert Davis, Mazda, thank you very much for joining us today and giving us the insights to this technology. I mean, it really is cool stuff. I mean,
yeah, looking forward to it.
It isn't all that often you get to talk to somebody who's, you know, developing engine stuff that is advanced because...
And speaking of engines, can I get a quick one in? Since you mentioned the rotary concept from a couple of years ago being a kind of a diversionary tactic for us, the press, in the automotive press... same thing this year with the with what we'll see at Tokyo?
Well, I think we announced today and showed a teaser of a concept today for the Tokyo Motor Show. And I think you're going to see in Tokyo that what we've always said is rotary engines are important to Mazda. They're an important part of our history. We consistently and ongoing develop rotary technology as we see the landscape going, and I think you're going to see that that statement is true.
Well, I really enjoyed watching the GTU RX-7s race at Road America back in the day, so good to see that you've got that on
the Yeah, on it's going to be fun. Just don't tell my wife. She doesn't know yet.
Okay.
All right. Robert, thank you very much, and we're going to take a quick break and hear from Lear.
Lear Kinexus offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts, all delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Okay, and we are back. So this is the time of the show where we do the Dr. Data number, and you guys are both veterans of Dr. Data.
Veterans or victims?
I would say veteran bad guesser.
Yeah.
This one, I don't know. I think you guys may get it. So Carmen, please bring up the first image. Okay, so that's 5.13 miles per hour. What could 5.13 miles per hour be? Now, they cheat when they make these slides. Now, those of you who are listening on Stitcher don't realize what the image shows, but if you identify what that image is back there, you'll know what it is.
I was going to say, I already figured this has got to be some sort of average speed, probably to do with commuting. The picture is a pretty big hint. Todd, do you want to give me the guess, or you have
is that?
All right, go for it, Mike.
I'm guessing it's the average speed in London.
It's the average speed in London. Yeah. So, you know, I was in London on vacation last week, and I saw this number, and it was astonishing. Now, okay, so basically, 5 miles per hour is the average speed for someone to drive in a vehicle in London.
Yeah.
Okay, the average speed of a person walking is 2.5 miles per hour.
Yeah.
So basically, you're just going twice as fast as walking.
A bicycle would be 12 miles an hour.
Yeah, 15 years ago, which makes me feel old, but 15 years ago, I spent a summer in London, and there was a transit strike one day, and it was faster. You know, taking the tube was the fastest, but taking walking and skateboard was still faster than driving.
You know, and this is the thing that sort of strikes me is that, you know, okay, in the automotive press, we're always enamored by things like, so Todd, to go back to the Frankfurt situation, and
yep.
We were talking about the Mercedes AMG Project 1,000
yes.
horsepower vehicle.
Yep.
Okay, so
Formula One powered vehicle.
Yes.
Yeah.
So when we see average speed of 5 miles per hour in a city center, a wealthy city, by the way, so people might have the money to
with a good transit system.
And Mike's wearing his Haggerty shirt with the four-speed gear shift knob on it, which I think of Los Angeles as being the city that single-handedly is putting the death knell to the manual transmission. I mean, I've spoken with many people who say, well, I buy a stick shift, but I live in L.A. Why would I want to do that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're bumping along in first gear on the freeway
right.
To get to work. First, maybe second if you're lucky.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, London, this is going to sound very un-car guy-like, but I think we're ultimately heading toward large cities having very limited car access, and I think that may be a good thing. I think cars, it just doesn't do any good to have so many cars try to get into a city like New York, like London, like San Francisco, or Los Angeles, or parts of Los Angeles. You
mm-hmm.
couldn't ban them all together. But, you're much faster moving using either public transit or walking or biking. I think that's inevitable,
mm-hmm.
and I think we're heading toward that.
So speaking of that, Jim Hackett, who is the president and CEO of Ford, went to Wall Street this week and started laying out Ford's vision of the future and its aspirations to be come the most trusted mobility provider. And as part of the presentation, he showed things like e-bikes and other things. I mean, is it likely that we're going to be seeing more of this from traditional auto manufacturers where they're going to have alternative types of vehicles, or is that just a sort of a one-off or looks good for Wall Street?
I think that was a smart move to get in the e-bike sort of thing. You know, whether the competition will do it or whether they'll let that go to, traditional bike manufacturers and traditional mass transit manufacturers, I think that's more likely. I think we're probably seeing an inevitable shrinking of the auto industry just in terms of, we probably have, especially with China coming on board with all their new brands, how many more brands can we have? Mm-hmm. Fortunately or unfortunately, we're in for a change that would seem like a shock if we could predict what it's going to be like in 2030 or 2050. But it'll happen gradually, and we've already seen a lot of brands go away in the last 20 years or so. Mm-hmm. And transportation is changing, and autonomy is inevitable, and that's going to change our enthusiasm for the brand. We'll all be automobile and all the other magazines will be like Haggerty's magazine, just writing about old cars that you can drive.
I think it's smart hedging, because they're prepping for, we need to maybe make things other than cars or be known for things other than cars. But I don't know if that, with autonomy, going back to congestion, right? We're not solving the issue of people driving singularly in cars. Autonomy offers some things where, okay, maybe you have carpooling, maybe you have closer traffic spacing, but the fundamental issue is there's too many people driving, a four-person car with one person in it, and autonomy doesn't solve that. So maybe we're going to have that iPhone moment where the whole market changes all of a sudden. I agree with Todd, it's probably going to be more gradual, but an e-bike prepares you for, I don't think autonomy is going to cause that change, but autonomy could force the issue where you go, these roads are so crowded that all of a sudden, maybe people do abandon it en masse and get into bikes and get into transit and move closer to where they work.
One of the things I was wondering about is that, okay, if we go back to the beginning of Henry Ford developing the Model T, mm-hmm. and all the variations that he made off the Model T.
And give Ransom Olds some credit because he was a little bit ahead of that but didn't do it at the same scale.
But I'm talking about in terms of use your Model T as a tractor. Use your Model to put a belt on it to cut wood and on. So we've historically had a car that is capable of doing things that are far beyond our need. So were you to be in Traverse City today and having to drive down here, it would probably not be something that you would do in an electric vehicle or most electric vehicles, right? So, but if you were in Ypsilanti and you were coming here, you could use an electric vehicle. So what I begin to wonder about is that shouldn't there be a shift in the auto industry in terms of developing vehicles that are more fit to purpose rather than fit to do everything?
Fit to purpose. Well,
you want to go across town, you don't need, you personally want to go across town, you don't need a big vehicle.
I mean, that's the fundamental challenge of EVs, though, right? Automakers have been telling people for 20 years, the average trip is less than what, like 12 miles, and 60 miles of range is plenty for you. You look at SUVs, how often do people use the full towing capacity? How often do they use the full cargo? There's a cultural piece as Americans that we always want to have a little bit left over. And then there is the practical point that the few times you need that do-it-all ability, like the one time you have to make a business trip out of town, it's a huge problem. It may not be a huge problem, but it's not that much of a burden to just have the do-it-all all the time. And then you get into manufacturing challenges and price competition. It's hard to make diversity, diverse products.
Well, that's the thing. Part of this kind of gradual shift, I think, will be that you're already seeing, maybe only electric cars in certain cities in Paris and Berlin, London, wherever. And of course, manufacturers are kind of combining autonomy with with electrical vehicle development. They think that the two go together pretty well, and that's a pretty good argument. So you might, so before you have a point where maybe you have no personal cars at all in certain cities, you have geofenced areas with autonomous electric cars. And electric cars make a lot of sense because of those short trips in many cities, Detroit as well as New York or London. But the problem, of course, is still that that sort of car wants to be a $15,000 or $20,000 car, not a $35,000 car. So it still comes down to the cost, and it comes down to, I think, we're entering a even greater struggle now between free market and what people really want to buy, and governments saying we need to do this, and the government that will basically determine that is China. Mm-hmm. They're going to run the whole thing as far as EV development goes, I think, and mm-hmm. as far as getting more people in the EVs.
Well, to that point, the EV in China, so earlier this week, General Motors announced that it will release 20 all EV cars within the next 5 years.
Kevin, 2023, yeah.
So right. Kevin Fetty wants to know, will they source their batteries and motors from LG, basically as they've done for the Chevy Bolt, or will they go to somebody like Tesla? I mean, obviously there's battery constraint. And clearly this play of doing some of these vehicles is to meet the mandates in China. But
yeah.
So what do you think?
And GM Mark Reuss talked about a new kind of expandable or a variable sort of platform for the second 18 of the vehicles. There will be two in the next 18 months that will be based on the Chevy Bolt platform or technology. And then they've got obviously something better next coming after that that will include these 18 or so vehicles by 2023. And by the way, they're talking all sorts of brands. So that means a Buick and a Cadillac that might look like a Chevy or a GMC that looks like the Chevy utility or whatever. But I'd be surprised to see them buy it from Tesla, frankly.
Okay, you are getting back to built for a purpose, though, because the best part about EVs is, you know, you're almost back to a body on frame, not quite, but, you know, the powertrain is fairly modular, and you can put anything on top of it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, here's what we're going to do. So last week's question we didn't get. It was recorded. It was taken in. We're going to play that. Then we're going to take a break. Then we're going to come back, and we're going to be joined by someone who has never been on the show before. So, Carmen, could you bring in Jonathan Brown's question, please?
Hey, guys. It's Jonathan out in New Jersey. Great show, as always. Curious, what do you guys think about that Volvo XC40 electric, all-electric CUV? You think it'll be out before I don't know, the middle of 2018 in the United States for delivery? Or are we dreaming and it's 2019? What about Jaguar's I-Pace? And I don't know, maybe Mercedes electric vehicle. I got a deposit on a reservation on a Tesla Model 3 that I made April Fool's Day 2016, and I'm hoping to get it by the end of 2018, but if one of those other little CUVs comes up, I want to pick one of those up in addition to my Corvette. Let me know. Thank you. Great show.
Do you know anything, Todd?
I'd say, well, first of all, on the Tesla Model 3, I'd say it depends on where he's on the queue. The production is not going to go up very quickly. But Volvo, I'm not as familiar with that as the Jaguar. The Jaguar they're talking about released by the end of next year. You will see production versions at maybe L.A. or Detroit or something like that. But, the Jaguar end of next year, that's probably going to be priced up against the Model X. And I think that could be a significant threat to that end of the Tesla line. I think we'll probably see the Porsche...
Mission E,
Porsche sedan... soon. Oh, we also have, and this is also at Frankfurt, the fuel cell Mercedes GLC class sometime in the middle of next year. And of course, that's fuel cells, which means you've got to find a hydrogen station, and there are, you know, maybe three in L.A. or something like that.
I think the 8th is National Hydrogen Day, just
yeah.
so you know. So
just
prepare. Get balloons.
Exactly. As far as Volvo goes, I think I'm not sure, but I'd say more like 2019
yeah,
instead
I think
of 2018.
So too. Okay, so we got to take a quick break. We're overdue for that. We're going to hear from our friends at Bridgestone. Appreciate their support. So Bridgestone, then we're going to have a surprised, not exactly a guess, but so Bridgestone. Okay, we're back. So Sean McElroy, this is your debut on AutoLine After Hours. For people who watch AutoLine daily, they see you on a most regular basis.
Yeah.
And but they've never seen you in this venue. And
yeah. Very cool to finally get a chance to be on. That's
so
for sure.
So
have you gone through the hazing yet?
Oh, of course. I mean, come on. You know, work with the dad and brother. Of course, you gotta get a little bit of razzing in there, right?
Mm-hmm. So. You got the opportunity to drive the Demon.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Oh, my gosh. What an experience. That car is amazing. I was fortunate enough. I had a Charger Hellcat to go out to drive the Demon and then got in the Demon and did that. But what an amazing car. The acceleration on that thing is just unbelievable. To go from, as I said, the Hellcat to that, it was just... There are
right, literally 707 horsepower for the Demon, and the Hellcat is...
No, the Hellcat's 707.
Okay.
The Demon, depending on what kind of fuel you have in the vehicle, depends. So we actually had the chance to drive down the drag strip on race fuel, so that meant full 840 horsepower out of the car. And then they also had a street one available for us as well, which was on premium fuel, which is 808 horsepower on that, so... You know, 101 more horses than the Hellcat, and you can definitely tell.
See, this gets back to my fit for purpose, see? So when you have your face with a drag strip, you probably want that car, right?
Right.
You don't want to drive that car from Traverse City.
Or in London.
Because you couldn't afford it. Because,
well, you don't want to drive it in London.
You know, because gasoline is so expensive.
Well, you might, though, because the Hellcat, if I remember correctly, they've softened up the suspension so that it'll squat better at the drag strip. So it might act, how does it compare on the street? Like driving around town.
That was one of the cool parts is they are two completely different cars the way they were set up for us to drive.
And you know, you change the tires out, obviously, and that's a huge part of that equation.
Well, right, the whole Demon box, all the goodies that you get in there, that was on the drag strip for us. So, you know, skinny front tires, no side view mirror, that sort of thing. They had all that stuff set up for the drag strip and then the one for the street. And you know, one of the things that kind of struck me is I heard some rumblings of people talking about, oh, is it safe to have an 840 horsepower car that someone can go out and buy and drive on the street? And I felt with the tires that come on the Demon, it is actually more controllable and easier to drive than the Hellcat is. So
give us the result. What was your ET? What was your...
They did not have the stuff set up for us,
really?
But there is in the infotainment screen, you can go through and they have an ET set up in there. And based on what the readouts were saying, getting down into about the mid to low 10-second range, which,
wow.
I mean, even on a slow run, it felt like you were doing 12s down the quarter mile. It was amazing. And then... They have all the line locks set up to where you can control the car and preload the tires, and it'll actually build up boost beforehand, too. You can build up to 8 pounds of boost with the car as well. So you can really, I mean, I've never been in anything that pulled an entire full quarter mile the whole way.
Was your face like this all the way?
I felt like it. Well, you know, my smile might have been helping that, too. But, yeah, What a treat.
You just got back from driving something. Can you talk
you
about
know what?
It?
Well, yeah, I can. It's not embargoed. And actually,
it
I got this trip before the Demon. So I could have gone on the Demon, but I was already committed to the Buick Enclave.
And you're a responsible
which does not
man.
Do,
that's what I would say.
which does not do low 10-second quarter miles. But it's a very nice... nicely done update. It's an all-new version of the Enclave that has been on sale for 10 years. now, and also getting pretty pricey if you get the Avenir, which is close to, that's the old one, isn't it? That looks like, yeah, that's the old one. Got to find the new one.
People are listening on Stitcher. It doesn't matter.
Okay, all right.
All right, so.
Yeah.
So, okay, so this is the all-new Enclave. Now, right. So there's an all-new Traverse.
Yes.
And then there's
same
an
platform.
All-new Acadia.
The Acadia is on a shorter, the Acadia has been shortened. So
right.
This is a way to get a little more distant between the, distance between the Buick and the GMC that often share the same showroom. That the Acadia can be had with a third row, but there's no extra cargo space behind that third row if you have the seats up. In the case of the Buick Acadia, the Buick Enclave. In the case of the Buick Enclave, it's a little bit larger than the model it replaces. The wheelbase is now 120.3 inches, I think, so it's about 2 more inches. They have an automatic damping system, a variable damping system in the available with the Avenir. They have a nicer interior. It's been upgraded. They still have some problems with like the door cards where you have the storage area
map pockets.
Below. Yeah, it's still a little cheap in terms of the plastic, but the leather is very nice throughout the car, and they Buick quiet tuned it, so it's got triple laminated glass, makes it quieter than the Chevy Traverse, which is the same platform. Starts at $40,000 for a base model, $40,000 and change, and the Avenir with most everything standard on it, somewhere in the $56,000 range.
So if somebody wants the full download from you, they should go to
automobilemag.com as soon as I finish the story.
Automobilemag.com
as soon as I finish the story. Also comes with just one engine again, the 3.6 liter, but this is an updated version of the old engine. Now makes 310 horsepower in this model and coupled to the new 9-speed automatic.
Okay, so we've got some more questions here. I'm going to put three together, so I'll ask this first. Fourth separately. Have any of you had the opportunity, this is from Tony, have any of you had the opportunity to drive the Nissan ProPilot system? If so, how does it compare to Tesla's Autopilot?
I've driven ProPilot, not Tesla's Autopilot. I can compare it with Cadillac Super Cruise. I'm sorry, have you driven it?
I have not.
Okay.
I've driven it.
Driven it?
I saw the Twitter comments. That's about it.
The Nissan system is very conservative. You do have to keep your hands on the steering wheel. It helps steer around around curves on the freeway. It will come to a complete stop and then go as long as you start up again in less than 3 seconds.
Yeah.
I think it is. But it's very conservative, even certainly compared with the Cadillac Super Cruise. And Cadillac Super Cruise now with the pullback that Tesla has done on its autopilot. Is probably a little more advanced than the Tesla system, at least for now.
Okay, so they're all in the theme related to electric vehicles. Okay, so AG says, so I'm going to ask them all, so we're not going to, okay, so we're, AG wants to know, what kind of infrastructure is needed for EVs? Developing markets are heavily dependent on fuel-efficient internal combustion engine models. Nike HM69 says, having lived through Hurricane Irma and watched thousands try to evacuate the state of Florida, that showed me the limitations of owning an electric car as a primary vehicle. And SubGR77 says, EVs are great, but at current conditions, it should be the runaround town car with a second vehicle for that long trip. Okay, so we've got two on infrastructure, basically, saying, what do you need, and what about things like hurricanes and other natural disasters, and then one saying, should this be your local town car? So who wants to start?
I started last time, so.
I don't know all the infrastructure answers. I will start with that. But natural disasters is this perfect example. If you think of Hurricane Sandy, Superstorm Sandy. That was in the winter in the Northeast. So imagine not having power for 3 days And, you know, so, you know, you're worried about keeping your house warm and or just driving away to safety, and you won't be able to do that with an EV. Or, you know, Puerto Rico, I think they're at 9% of the island has power now. As I understand it, the current state of solar panels in the U.S., if you get panels on your house, you're not, by the default, the most common setup, you're not setting up a battery backup system. You're not actually giving power to your house. You're just helping put more power into the grid. So in that case, you know, to get to the level of infrastructure where you have widely distributed electrical generation and the storage to be able to say, okay, we've had a disaster, we can get the electric panels back up. It seems a long way off.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like an argument for fuel cells, doesn't it?
It does.
Let's ship a bunch of fuel cell Toyotas to Puerto Rico and have them power up the
It seems to me, you know, this whole thing of like, gee whiz, you know, if you have an electric car and the energy's knocked out, then you're screwed. Well, it seems to me that if you have an internal combustion engine car and you don't have gas in it and the energy is knocked out, then you go to your local BP station and they're going to say, see ya.
And if either electric or fuel cell or gasoline-powered car got drowned, it doesn't matter anyway, right? I mean, it may not start no matter what.
I mean, going back to Puerto Rico, once they get the diesel to the island and get it distributed, everything's ready to go, that's going to be – there'll be trucks moving or are trucks moving way before they have the electrical grid back up.
Mm-hmm. As far as a commuter car, yeah, right now the electric car is perfect as a commuter car. Tesla is trying to set up the system where there are enough superchargers across the country and across Europe even, where you can go on a trip, and as long as you're willing to take a half hour, maybe longer, I don't remember the exact amount of time, a break rather than a 10-minute refueling at a Shell station, or mobile, I don't want to single out anyone. You can drive it cross country. But really, these at this point are made for commuter cars, and that's why the price is a problem, even at $35,000. I spent a few days in a Chevy Bolt a while back, and because of its range, I didn't feel I had to charge it at my home at night, which because of my driveway is a little bit challenging, so I just let it. I just charged it at the office where we have a charger, and I also used one of those things at the Dunkin' Donuts once, just to try it out. And I felt very confident being able to drive it a couple days around town without worrying about whether it's fully charged up or not.
Have you had any experience with EVs, John?
Yeah, quite a bit. I mean, I would say that, you know, there's still such a small part of the market, too, that, you know, is there really great incentive right now to build up the infrastructure when they only account for such a small part? And then on top of that, the technology is changing so quickly all the time. You know, if we build up this huge infrastructure for, you know, type A EV right now, you know, type B EV in the future, is it going to be able to use the same kind of charging? So
there's also some politics involved. If you think about how hard it is now politically in this country to do away with coal-fired power plants, how the
clean coal is not a problem.
How the Koch brothers alone are trying to help shape policy and shape politics in this country, for good or bad, no matter what you think about that. Think about the oil industry when the auto industry says, okay, we're ready to get rid of gasoline or diesel-powered cars. We're going to go to all electric. Well, you know, once if there's an infrastructure there in 10 or 20 or 30 years and the auto companies do that, the resistance by the oil industry, which still remains pretty strong, it'll be a challenge. It'll be interesting to watch.
Completely anecdotal, real quick. It is popping up. So like Traverse City, where our home office is, they have EV chargers at hotels and in like city parking garages. And Traverse City is a fairly small town in northern Michigan. But by virtue of having a level 2 chargers there, it then unlocks it to people that are 150 or 200 miles away. So whereas before, Grand Rapids maybe, you might not get an EV because you have to make that trip or you want to make that trip. As soon as a remote city, as soon as those satellites start adding their infrastructure, it starts, you know, it enables people from other city centers. So mm-hmm.
Yeah, start connecting the dots.
Yeah. So this is a popular topic, obviously. Joe Laszlo says, the charging time on a Tesla for a road trip gets tedious after the novelty wears off. Only so much time you can spend in a Cracker Barrel parking lot. And he also says gas stations have backup generators. We were out of power for 4 days, and we were always able to get gas. Well, when there was that power outage in southeast Michigan, what was it, eight, 9 years ago, that massive power failure, we didn't have gasoline. So not all gas stations have backup generators.
And I may be the only one old enough here. Maybe you do, remembering the lines after the OPEC embargoes.
Mm-hmm. Or after 9/11.
Yeah.
Same thing. Yeah. All right. So, okay, just really lightning round, because I'm just interested in what you guys have to say about this, and then we'll end the show. Okay. So September sales were really robust. Is that a consequence of the aforementioned hurricanes, or is there demand in the market? I mean, it broke an eight-month down streak, and it went up. What do you think? Hurricanes or demand?
I think a combination of the two. I think this is a temporary blip. I think we're going to level off again and stick around the 17 million roughly, which is still not bad.
Mike?
Hurricanes. The conservatism of Ford's new balance sheet, I think, is an example of how cautious everyone is.
I'm with Mike on this one. Hurricanes. I think it's both, as Todd said, but I think largely hurricanes.
So in October, if we have no hurricanes, and we hope that we have no hurricanes, it'll be a decline.
I was reading that there's a one about to hit this weekend, coming off, starting in Nicaragua. So
car dealers everywhere.
But I wonder. So maybe you're both right about the hurricanes, but given how recent those were people able to get into dealerships that quickly and buy the cars?
Yeah, were their insurance companies pay off?
I don't know how quickly that happens when you've got a mass.
Right.
Payoff due, but I'll take your word for it.
And we're talking about, we mentioned Tesla and part of the problems, and this will be the last thing, and then we'll leave. So Tesla, you mentioned this, Todd, about the Model 3 production being rather anemic.
I suspect that the 266 built so far were pretty much hand-built,
right?
I think, yeah.
You think that's going to change anytime soon?
I've seen, there's a report today from Daily Kanban about these production pieces being built here. Was it a production line, basically?
There's a stamping facility.
The stamping facility, right. But the idea is that they're going to move that out to, that's supposed to go from here in Michigan to Fremont, California. From what I've seen and heard, the Model 3 assembly line isn't set up yet, and I've been saying for months now that I don't see how Tesla is going to come close to the production goals that Elon Musk has set half a million per year by sometime the end of this year or beginning of next year. That's way beyond what's really going to happen.
Okay, final question to you, Mike. When are we going to stop talking about Tesla?
When are we going to stop talking about Tucker?
Yeah, I don't know. It's always exciting. Even, you know, bad news or good news, it could be the Model 3. If it doesn't get going. No, actually, no. Okay, sorry. It took me a while to get to it. We will never stop talking about Tesla because, in the worst case scenario, someone will buy it and then we'll continue to talk about them.
Okay. All right. With that, I want to thank you, Todd Lassa, automobilemag.com.
Yes.
And buy the physical copy because
which is,
you know,
just called Automobile Magazine.
Yeah, and yes. I think that you know, physical, it's better for your livelihood if they buy the physical copy. That said,
I like print.
It's a better revenue. Digital Content Manager of Hagerty. Now, you guys have something that people can go online and see what you're up
to? Yeah, if you go to Hagerty.com, we have a section of articles and videos where we're putting up stories all the time and videos. And we also have a magazine. Right now it's offered to, you can add on Hagerty Plus to your insurance, but we're working on something to spread it to more people. But,
and you guys have quite a crew, quite a crew over there, right?
Yeah.
So tell us who some of the people are. That
Larry,
I'm sure.
Webster, former editor of Road and Track. Aaron Robinson, longtime writer, well-known guy. Jonathan Stein, he used to edit Automotive Quarterly. He's been with Hagerty a long time, mm-hmm. but an all-star crew.
Yeah, you do have an all-star crew.
And a couple of my former colleagues.
Yes.
Sandon Volker and Eric Wiener. Mm-hmm. Am I missing anybody? Those two, yes.
Yeah. So, okay. Sean McElroy, people can see you tomorrow at noonish?
At noonish, yeah.
At noonish.
Autoline.tv.
Autoline.tv. So, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Oh, wow. Shaking the hands.
Shaking the hand. You put it out there. I had to shake the hand.
That was just my gesture. So, anyway, okay. Thanks, all of you, for spending, overtime with us. And we will see you here next week.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems. And by Hyundai, better drives us.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons, get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.